Today, how European migration policy has shaped a crisis on the island of Lesbos and a political earthquake in Ireland.
We all remember the height of the refugee crisis is like images of vast numbers of people arriving boat after boat after boat onto the island.
Guardian reporter Harriet Grant recently visited the Greek island of Lesbos. It sits just off the coast of Turkey and has become synonymous with Europe's migration crisis. For people fleeing countries like Syria and Afghanistan, Lesbos became their gateway to Europe. And at the height of the crisis in 2015, hundreds of thousands of migrants were passing through it. Now there are far fewer people coming. But as Europe has made it harder for people to try and begin a new life on the continent, those that have risked the journey are finding themselves trapped. With the island's main camp Moria at capacity, thousands are being forced to build shelters around it.
The noise everywhere you go is hammering. People are pulling apart pallets, stretching tarpaulin over them. It's like a hive of building. This camp is growing every single day.
But so are tensions. And now the UN's refugee agency has called for thousands of people to be evacuated to the Greek mainland. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, life on Lesbos.
If you're leaving Syria or Afghanistan and you want to get to Europe, you go through Turkey, and the Aegean Islands are one of those first landing stages into Europe. You can see Turkey from the shore. The moment you arrive in Lesbos, you can see the lights twinkling. It's a lot closer than, for example, Calais is to Dover.
How do people end up on the island? How do they get there?
They come by boat, very small boats, from the Turkish coast, usually, but not always at night. It's about 4 hours on open sea. It's very cold. While I was there, people drowned. People are dying regularly.
And it was an accident last night. They found eight people dead. Most of them, I think, were children.
I was with a photographer called Georgios Moutafas, who's been reporting on the island for 13 years. That's when he first started seeing boats coming in.
The water is really cold. You cannot stay in the water.
So it's a hypothermia risk?
Yes, hypothermia.
Although he lives in Athens, he feels very strongly about it and goes back all the time to see what's happening in Lesbos. We went to the north of the island. Georgios told me that that was where the boats came in, and that if I wanted to see one come in, that he was in touch with people and would get an alert. So he said to me, go to bed, keep your phone by your head, and I will call you, and you have 3 minutes to get in the car, and then we'll go.
It's 6 o'clock in the morning, is that right? 6:30.
Yes.
And
he called me, and we just got up to go and find the boat.
Says that the refugees arrive in a beach.
By which point they had come off the shore and built a fire in an olive grove, and that's where we found this group. People and children, toddlers, huddled around a fire, and they were sending the children out into the olive grove to get more sticks to build the fire up. They all looked freezing cold. They didn't have very many belongings with them because the smugglers don't let them bring very much on the boat, so they didn't have lots of blankets or coats or food. And they were just waiting for a bus that was going to come pick them up and take them to the Moria camp.
Who were the people on this boat? Did you speak to some of them?
Yes, they were all from Afghanistan. There was one girl who spoke very good English. She was translating for the Coast Guard, who was very talkative, that I began chatting to immediately. I'm going to refer to her as Jalila.
The place that we live is Dahni Ghuri. It's the main place of Taliban. They do not allow girls to go to school.
She said, in my village that I'm from, the Taliban have taken control. They want girls to be married early.
To forcibly go get married with a man, with a person with whom, and you don't know about who is he. And
she explained her father had protected her from early marriage. She was saying, they come for you as soon as you're 13, they want you, but my dad is an unusual man and he kept sending them away and lying about my age to protect me.
They come to my father, give your daughter to get married. She's small.
Then she explained she went to Kabul.
During 2 years, three times, I get near to die.
Said, but there were bombs everywhere in Kabul. Oh, she said, my class got blown up while I was studying in it. And then a short while later, a huge bomb went off when I was in the traffic in Kabul. She said, my father was easygoing, open-minded. I was very lucky. He helped me escape and now I'm here. And she was saying, but my dad's really worried about me. He even asked to speak to the other people on the boat.
My father talked with all of them and I said, take care of my daughter, please. She's alone.
It sounds very clear what she was running away from, but did she know where she wanted to go?
No, interestingly, she had no idea. She said, I just want to come to Europe. Europe was this ideal for her. She said, my father's told me that Europe is safe for girls, which again made me feel sad because there's nothing safe about Moria camp for girls. However, it's true that Europe is safer than Afghanistan for girls.
And I want to study. I want freedom. Just freedom. And
she said to me, I can't wait to continue with my education. Do you think I'll be able to start school as soon as I get to the camp? But I'd been in Moria camp already on this visit and my heart sank at what was waiting for her there.
So boats are arriving every day on the island. Where do people go when they arrive?
So they either go to an intermediary camp called Karatepe, run by the UN, which I believe is fairly well run, or they go to the big camp, Moria, which has gone since July from 5,000 to 19,000 in just 6 months. It has grown phenomenally. And most of those people are living outside the official camp in an olive grove. They're literally pushing back. You can see it growing. And when you're there, people are walking up to the edge of the camp looking for somewhere to put their bit of tarpaulin.
And how are the people you met on the beach settling in?
I got a WhatsApp message from Jalila later that night saying, we arrived, there's nowhere for us, there's no shelter. They've given something for the families, but not for me. And I thought she meant that they'd put the families inside the official camp. What she meant is they'd given the families a tiny two-man tent for eight people, like you would take to Glastonbury if you were a student, that type of tent. And they'd given her nothing.
And they gave me a coat and a blanket and they didn't give me a shelter.
So she came down to meet us at the edge of the camp and we sort of weaved our way up through this thousands of people and kids.
Oh, sorry.
Hello.
Sorry.
And disgusting dirt and mess and rubbish everywhere. And we found the little spot where she was sleeping. One family had said to her, come and share our tent, but she literally couldn't fit in. So she'd just gone back to the path.
Did you feel scared?
No, I didn't feel scared. Cause
and she wasn't worried about that?
No, she said it felt less dangerous than when she was with the smugglers on the path travelling. I think perhaps because she'd found a corner surrounded by families.
Is that a typical experience for people when they first arrive?
Yes, I think it is increasingly typical now that the main camp is full. And the camp is also seen as so dangerous and unpleasant inside. The unaccompanied minors that I met there tended to choose to come and sleep in the olive grove. They felt safer.
Why?
Because there's fighting inside the camp. It's very, very crowded and a lot of fighting. In fact, a guy from Yemen was stabbed to death just after I left. A 20-year-old from Yemen was stabbed to death in a fight.
That's terrifying. Talked about how filthy and dirty the camp is. What is the health like of some of the people you met there?
One of the families on the boat had two sick children, a little boy who had a fever and looked unwell. But more worryingly, his little sister, who was about 18 months old, had a bad cut on her foot that had happened on the journey in Turkey. It had been bandaged once by a medic they'd met in Turkey. They took her shoe off. She immediately started screaming in pain. It was yellow, seeping out of dirty bandages, and it really disturbed me to see. And I felt her forehead and she had a temperature. That was on a Saturday, and they'd been told there was no doctor available until Monday. Médecins Sans Frontières have actually recently said that there are at least 140 children with what they describe as chronic, complex and life-threatening diseases. That is just put into context how worrying the situation there is. and MSF have asked for those really seriously ill children to be moved to a hospital on the mainland. So given how children with really problematic health conditions are not being treated, it's difficult for a family with a child with an injury like this to get treated quickly.
These camps have been a fixture on Lesbos for so long, and there were reports recently of protests there against the Greek government's handling of this crisis. What do you think the impact has been for people living on the island?
I think the majority of people are appalled and sad and horrified wherever on the political spectrum they come from. Nobody wants that near their home. Georgios said to me when we arrived, the village where the boats tend to arrive on the North Shore, he said everyone here, their whole life is completely bound up now with these arrivals, with rescuing, with helping, with supporting. But what can people do? The boats keep arriving.
How long are people spending in this camp? How long are they there for?
So this is the crux of the problem there, is that at the height of the refugee crisis, far larger numbers of people were travelling through Lesbos. There were several boat arrivals a day. Sometimes 50 boats were arriving a day. Well, now we're not seeing that now, but they can't leave now. There's a bottleneck. If you go down to the port in Lesbos, the tourist cruisers are coming in and out. There are teenagers with their noses pressed up against the fences, sort of mournfully watching the ferries, but there's no way of them getting on them. The bottleneck in the asylum system in Greece is very, very... Like, you might be given a two-year appointment date. Imagine arriving in Moria and being told, yeah, we're going to hear your claim for asylum in 2 years.
Someone who has witnessed the growing number of cases on Lesbos firsthand is Philip Worthington, a lawyer with the NGO group European Lawyers in Lesbos. They help people with their asylum claims, but struggle to cope with demand.
There are somewhere between 20 to 25 lawyers at most working on the island and 21,000 asylum seekers. The vast majority of people go through the process without speaking to a lawyer. You know, thinking of a situation on Lesbos and in Moria, you may not think that lawyers are the kind of very important or the first thing that people need. You know, of course, people immediately think of shelter, wash facilities, food and security and issues like that, all of which are, of course, extremely important. But actually, at the heart of the issue and at the heart of everything that's going on Lesbos and the other Aegean islands is the legal process. For some people, it could genuinely be a matter of life and death.
If you are an asylum seeker or migrant arriving on Lesbos with the intent to travel further into Europe, what are the options that are available to you?
The way that the European and international legal framework operates is on the principle that asylum seekers apply for asylum in the first country of arrival. So for everybody coming across from Turkey, that is Greece. In terms of potential onward movement, actually, there is only currently one mechanism available for that, and that's family reunification under the Dublin regulation, whereby, in brief, asylum seekers can apply to be reunited with their family members in other European member states. But in many cases, and say I'd say actually in the vast majority of cases, onward movement from Greece is not really what's in people's minds when they arrive. What is in people's minds is being granted asylum and international protection in order to not be returned to Turkey and then their home country.
My colleague Harriet Grant, who's visited Lesbos, said the situation on the island has become a bit of a bottleneck. How has that situation changed since you've been on the island?
The situation has completely changed from when I first arrived, which was in January 2016. Before the EU-Turkey deal, so everybody who arrived on Lesbos was simply transitioning through the island.
Today, we reached a very important agreement between Turkey and EU.
Basically, the EU-Turkey deal was an agreement with Turkey under which
Turkey will be getting all those who are crossing to Aegean islands illegally, but meanwhile, European countries will receive the same number of legal migrants from Turkey.
It did, of course, have the result of reducing the number of people arriving on the island significantly, but it also had an additional outcome, which was the people go through the asylum procedure on the island, And that means that they're here for a long time.
At the beginning of the year, the Greek government passed a law which affects the asylum process. What difference has that made?
One of the changes is that now people who are vulnerable are also kept under the geographical restriction. So that means that both vulnerable individuals and non-vulnerable individuals stay on Lesbos throughout the duration of their asylum procedure. And we've kind of gone from one extreme to the other because people's cases are being determined very, very quickly. So, for example, people who arrived in early January would have their interviews in within about 7 working days with a decision to follow very soon after, which actually doesn't give enough time for people to prepare, to see a lawyer, to gather the documents and the evidence.
Okay, so before this, it was taking sometimes years to process asylum claims and people were getting stuck while they waited. But now these claims are being processed in a matter of days. Does this increase the likelihood then of people's claims being rejected?
I think it increases the likelihood of people who have a good basis for an asylum claim to be rejected, because in many cases, people don't understand that there are asylum criteria that they have to meet, that they have to demonstrate that they're at risk of persecution. So without knowing that, it's kind of like going into an interview or an exam without having had the opportunity to prepare. Over the last 3.5 years of our work, we've assisted over 10,000 people. And out of those, the people who have received their decision, 74.5% have been granted international protection, whereas the average rate in Greece is 46.5%. And this illustrates that there is over 30% of people who have a good case, but are not sufficiently well prepared to be able to present their case in a way that actually reflects their need for international protection.
Harriet, it's been a few weeks since you got back from Lesbos. What's been happening on the island since?
There's been definitely a ramping up of tensions. We've seen two things. Firstly, the Greek government has announced it is considering a floating barrier that would be there to deter people from making that sea journey from Turkey. What we know about it is going to be about 2.7 kilometres long. A netted barrier would rise from pylons 50 metres above the water and would be equipped with flashing lights to demarcate Greece's sea borders. I mean, just to say, there are already deterrents. Frontex boats patrol that area, the Turkish Coast Guard patrol that area, boats still get through. I don't know how that will work in practice. The other sign, I would say, of increasing tensions is that there were protests. I was getting messages from people that I met in the camp saying, "Have you seen we're going to protest today?" And they walked, it's sort of like a couple of miles from the camps into Mytilene, a tourist resort town. And they walked families and children to protest about the conditions. And they were met with riot police and tear gas.
What about Jalila? Have you heard from her?
Well, I asked her how the camp was in a WhatsApp message. And she said, "It's getting worse every night with killing and fighting." And then I asked her about the demonstration and she said, "Don't worry, my dear, I'm okay. I have some friends here, one family who didn't allow me to join the demonstration." And then she says, "We've provided Coca-Cola drink for people hurt by gas and the police attacked the kids and women with the gas. So we gave them water to wash their face and eyes."
God, it's heartbreaking, isn't it?
It's really sad. You know, no parent would put their child in danger on purpose. They went into that to have a peaceful demonstration. They didn't know that was going to be waiting for them.
Most of the reporting you've done in this area has been on the UK's response to the migration crisis. MPs have voted to remove the so-called Dubs Amendment from the Brexit withdrawal agreement. What does that mean?
We're talking about fairly small numbers. We know that if we take children, then fewer of them get trafficked.
So Lord Alf Dubs arrived in the UK aged 6 on the Kinder transport, which was arranged to bring children out of Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia. So in 2016, Lord Dubs managed to get an amendment to the withdrawal bill through under Theresa May, saying that the government has to protect the right of family reunion for unaccompanied minors when they're negotiating all the details of how we're going to coexist with Europe. And Boris Johnson said he didn't want to be tied to having any special requests from the EU, so he didn't want it to be on his list of things he promised to keep and promised to negotiate for. And there was a vote in Parliament and there was a vote in the Lords, and although the Lords supported the idea of pushing for the protection of child refugees, the government voted against it.
The question is that this House disagrees with the Lords in their Amendment 4. So any of that opinion, say aye.
And all Conservative MPs voted against it.
They were advised by the government to vote against it. The government actually wrote to all Conservative MPs spelling out all the ways in which they would still be protecting child refugees. And they wrote this letter which Safe Passage, who are the charity who campaign for child refugees, have debunked. And based on my own knowledge about refugees, I would agree that the letter that they wrote to their MPs is full of very misleading statements.
Is there any particular statistic that you'd pull out?
Yeah, I think the key one is they've said the UK granted protection to 7,500 children just in the last year, 41,000 children since 2010. Now, that does sound like a lot. However, our own Mark Townsend here reported recently a huge number of these came under lorries. They came unsafely. So it seems rather galling for the government to boast about its proud record of protecting children that it tried to stop coming here.
And what is the plan then? If the Conservative government don't want to enshrine this amendment in the withdrawal agreement, what will be the plan for helping refugees and migrants who are coming to this country?
Clearly, the most important thing is to stop them coming across from France.
They're signalling that moving out of the EU, one of the things they're going to be doing is tightening our borders further.
People thinking of making this journey, one, it is very hazardous. You may think the weather looks great, but it's a very, very dangerous thing to do. And the second thing is we will send you back.
However, the reality is that we are physically and geographically part of Europe. People arrive into the UK who may have made a first asylum claim in the EU, and we're going to want to be sending them back. So I think there's bluster and tough talk, but we will have to have a reciprocal relationship with Europe. Germany, Italy, France are not going to let us remove people back there under Dublin if we don't play some part in responsibility sharing for the refugee crisis. But I think the most important thing is we have avoided a lot of responsibility up till now. That isn't going to change.
You can read all of Harriet Grant's amazing reporting from Lesbos at theguardian.com. We contacted the Greek police about their response to the protests last week, and they told us that they arrested 11 men and 3 women after stones and objects were thrown at officers. A UK government spokesman also told us, "We have a proud record of helping vulnerable children, granting protection to 41,000 since 2010, and doing more than the vast majority of EU countries to help unaccompanied minors. Protecting vulnerable children remains our priority, and we have reaffirmed our commitment to family reunion in the EU Withdrawal Agreement Act." Coming up, Sinn Féin declares victory in Ireland's general election. Now, history was made in Ireland at the weekend when Sinn Féin, a party with past links to the IRA, won the most first preference votes in the country's general election. It's a huge upset for the two major ruling parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, which slid to second and third respectively, meaning that talks will now begin to form a coalition government. The Guardian's Lisa O'Carroll reflects on the significance of this result.
I think the exit poll on Saturday night at 10 o'clock had the same surprise factor that the exit poll in the election here on the 12th of December did. It's been called a revolution in Irish politics and the end of the two-party system that has dominated Ireland since the formation of the state nearly 100 years ago. Nobody expected Sinn Féin to do this well. They expected them to do very well, but not to top the polls. Sinn Féin have long been considered by the established parties as toxic, a party that neither the two big parties, Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, would get into bed with. And this is because of their association with the IRA and the troubles in Northern Ireland, and that probably was their only sort of calling card for a long time. And then they emerged in Dublin as a force within the inner city, a kind of party that took on working class issues, worked in the estates. And from there, it has built a party of the left, which may, in some circles, have parallels with Corbynism. There was a huge hunger for change and for an abolition of the old two-party system, with one party, Fianna Fáil, dominating politics for so long and blamed for causing the dreadful financial crash in Ireland in 2010. And then Fine Gael, who were the beneficiary of that, who became the government party in 2011, not doing enough to bring back some balance and equality in Irish society. Although the economy is now booming and Ireland is one of the biggest growing economies, if not the biggest growing economy in the EU, that isn't matched in public services. Housing was the number one issue in the election. Health was a close second. And Sinn Féin were there to capture that. On Brexit, there will be no change. All three parties are pro-EU and will support the Brexit deal that Leo Varadkar has sealed with Boris Johnson. There's another area where Sinn Féin stood out from Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, and that was Mary Lou MacDonald as leader. She's been very, very quickly able to turn issues into emotions. So a bit like Donald Trump or other populist leaders around Europe have shown that if you hit somebody with an emotional issue to buy into, then you may capture their vote. The election result speaks for itself. It shows that people in Ireland have put Sinn Féin in a different compartment now. They are not seen as the party of the IRA. They have set themselves up now as the party of change, but they haven't been in government before. And one of the big criticisms of Sinn Féin's manifesto is a bit like the Labour manifesto, is how do you cost the promises that they have made?
That was Lisa O'Carroll. Thanks to her, Harriet Grant and Philip Worthington. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. And the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back with you tomorrow.